Cincinnati had a record-shattering rainfall last Friday, followed by more storms Tuesday. Should residents and businesses be bracing for severe weather more often? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, the city's response to the storms, what happened with the Duck Creek floodgate, and the impact of climate change. Plus, the Ohio EPA's decision on how data centers can discharge their wastewater, and Roebling Bridge protesters arrested last year file lawsuits against the city of Covington and some of its police officers. Joining me now to get the news review started are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
And Cincinnati Inquirer Health and Environment Enterprise reporter Esther Launstein. Thanks so much for being here, Esther. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah. Well, Chris, how much rain did Cincinnati get in what amount of time during Friday's flash flooding? It was a lot.
Yeah, it was between 5 and 6 inches in about an hour, which, you know, as we talk to people who look at these things and statistics, you know, apparently may have been the largest single amount of rain that, you know, that this point in the city had received ever in the history of recorded weather.
Wow. Well, and then we had more rain on Tuesday. Chris, how many homes and businesses were affected by these storms? Do we have a count on that?
We know that about 1,500 at least homes have filed with the Metropolitan Sewer District to basically say we had our sewers backed up, we had damages. So it's at least that many. It's more than, you know, probably more than 1,500 at this point.
Becca, you have done a lot of work on the sewer system. I would suggest that all of our listeners check out the podcast Backed Up if they haven't already, because it's really, really well done. Are all those reports, these 1,500 or more than 1,500 reports of possible sewer backups, is that an indication that the sewer system failed or that the stormwater system failed? What does that say to you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So there's kind of two issues here. One is the flash flooding or the overland flooding that we saw, those kind of really dramatic videos where the water came up really high and did go away like pretty quickly. The other is what Chris mentioned, which is sewer backups. And that's when, what's in the sewer pipes goes back up into and overflows in a basement toilet or a floor drain or something like that. So those are kind of the two issues we're talking about here. What Cincinnati has is a combined sewer system. It's a really old style sewer system. It's common in older cities like in Cincinnati, and it works fine during dry weather. But when there is a major rainstorm like this, even a rainstorm much less severe than the one we saw this past Friday, it can overwhelm the system and cause these issues. So the sewer system was basically just not designed to handle situations like this. And we've been having issues. That's why we did the podcast a couple years ago, issues on a somewhat smaller scale. But as Chris mentioned, this storm would have overwhelmed any sewer system. You know, you could spend billions of dollars and not have a storm sewer system that could handle the amount of water that came through. And the city doesn't have billions of dollars to spend on that. So, did it fail? Not quite. It's an old sewer system. Replacing that sewer system requires bulldozing streets and buildings. I mean, this is all infrastructure that's underneath where we live and work and spend our time. So it's a money issue, and it's also just an infrastructure issue where, does it make sense to replace an entire system and spend, you know, billions of dollars for something that is not supposed to happen more than, every 1,000 years or so.
Yeah. Esther, I have heard some local officials call this like a 1,000-year storm, but is it even worse than that?
Yeah, so based on the amount of rain that we got within that hour span, so like Chris was saying, 5 to 6 inches, to classify as a 1,000-year storm, according to the NOAA Atlas 14 predictions, you have to get about 3.5 inches per hour. So we obviously got a lot more than that. And we don't really have a classification that goes beyond the 1,000-year classification. So yes, it was worse than that, but we don't have a way to classify that.
Esther, what's the science behind these storms? How do they dump so much water so quickly?
Yeah, so the science is, according to, the climatologist that I spoke to, it's really going back to, basic water cycle thermodynamics. What's happening is as the Earth heats up, especially during climate change, which we're noticing is bringing more heat to the area, the water is evaporating more frequently, and it's able to stay in the atmosphere for longer and kind of collect into a bigger storm. And then, you know, it falls as a more intense, more frequent rain activity.
Hmm. Becca, there's been a lot of concern over the Duck Creek floodgate. City Manager Cheryl Long said yesterday it didn't close properly on Friday, right? What happened?
That's right. So what they're saying is the gate does function properly as long as it is manually initiated. So the mechanisms that close the gate function properly. But what happened is there are sensors along Duck Creek that at one sensor level, it's supposed to close the kind of railroad arms across Madison Road to prevent traffic from driving through what may be high water or driving into the gate. At a slightly higher elevation, there's an automatic mechanism that should close the gate automatically. That's the part that has failed, that they determined after an investigation.
Okay. And I imagine closing it manually during Friday's storm would have been difficult and potentially dangerous.
What they said is it basically wasn't possible, and that's partly because, or maybe primarily because of how quickly the water mm-hmm. raised. There is apparently video footage of what happened in that area. The city stormwater management utility director said that based on what he's seen, it was about 45 minutes from kind of a normal level of the creek to completely flooded. Yeah. So, you know, getting out to the gate, I think it's also worth, you know, I don't think anybody expected this to be a 1,000-year-plus storm. You know, that was part of the expectation. I will say, too, we got a slightly smaller storm on Tuesday, the following Tuesday. On that day, knowing that there was rain in the forecast, the city did send out engineers. They manually closed the gate. You know, we had a reporter there and saw it happen. It didn't end up getting to the flood level where it needed to function. But it was evidence that, you know, we can see, and it can still operate from now until whenever it's fixed in this manual mode. Mm-hmm. There just needs to be somebody on site to do that.
Okay. Chris, what about these photos we've seen of chains attached to the floodgates, kind of traffic control railroad arms? Were those chains a factor in what happened Friday?
The city manager said, or one of the city officials, might have been the manager, might have been the stormwater utility person, but they said that was not a factor. That is, those chains were put there because of some malfunctioning and that basically stopped traffic. But they said that the chains themselves are not the reason that the floodgate itself malfunctioned.
So, Chris, what difference would it have made if that floodgate had closed automatically, if it had worked the way it was supposed to?
The city's position is that, or their analysis is that there are about 40 properties close to that floodgate and close to Duck Creek that were affected by it not closing. They believe that there still would have been adverse effects because of the amount of rain in that spot. May have been less severe in terms of the flooding. There's obviously a street very close there where we've seen a lot of news reporting, you know, basically showing that, you know, these folks had their basements flooded, their homes flooded. So it's not unclear, I think, exactly how severe it would have been, but they believe that it still would have been pretty bad for those folks.
And if I can, just worth putting like a very specific point on the fact that this floodgate has nothing to do with flooding in Hyde Park Square, for
right.
example, or
right.
Mount Lookout or other parts of the city, you know, not to minimize the damage or the concerns of the folks in that immediate area. But the gate was never designed to protect more than, you know, this immediate area around Madison Road.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened was the rain, you know, what we're told by MSD is that the rain was so quick and so much volume that some of the water never even reached the storms, you know, the stormwater utility, and then it didn't also reach MSD. So it was this river that we saw, you know, flowing down the street in Hyde Park. That was not a result of that floodgate. And mm-hmm. it may not really have been a result of the sewer system capacity mm-hmm. at that point.
Mm-hmm. Becca, does the city do regular testing to make sure that floodgate works?
So what we learned yesterday is the city does annual testing on that floodgate. It was last tested in October, and it was a successful test. However, what we also learned is that the testing that they've done is in manual mode, which, as we know, does function. That part is not a problem. The city has not been doing a testing of the automatic sensors. What the stormwater management utility official said is that it's not possible to test that unless the water is at a certain level. he kind of clarified later in the news conference that it's basically just a lot more complicated to test that. They were able this week to bring in additional resources, including people from outside the city that could mimic what it would look like if the creek were at that level. And that's how they were able to determine that it did fail and that test was not successful. So he said they are considering adding that to the annual testing moving forward. But again, that does require additional resources. It's not clear and too early to say what additional cost that might be.
Becca, have there been problems with the floodgate in the past?
Not quite. Chris did mention the known issue of the traffic control arms. There's a report as early as late 2020 that identified this problem. It's basically an issue with like a small transformer that's only related to those traffic arms. When the transformer fails, the arms close on a bright sunny day when there's no rain. It's blocking the traffic. It requires a crew to come out, manually raise the arms and keep them secured until that transformer can be replaced. So the city did know about that. But, you know, as we know now with the annual testing, there have not been any identified issues with the gate closing manual. And it seems like that does still work now. The city did have an RFP or RFQ, I can't remember which acronym, that was released earlier this year looking for a contractor to replace that system of the traffic arms. That RFP or whatever was canceled in June and is going to be, or at that time, the plan was to rebid that out in the new fiscal year, which starts July 1st. It's unclear what will happen there now because the city's obviously looking at that entire system and trying to make a more comprehensive plan for what to do.
Chris, there was a recommendation a few years ago to replace the Madison Road Bridge over Duck Creek. What did city officials say about that?
The interesting thing about that was that the cost of the bridge that they proposed, the engineering firm, whose name I will not mispronounce on air, started with a K, the cost of that was a little bit more than $2 million and change. But what the city told us on yesterday was that, you know, that wasn't it. They were going to need to acquire property. They were going to need to deal with railroads. Railroads are notoriously difficult to deal with property issues. They were going to need to acquire or whatever private property. And so they viewed it as way too expensive. And, that's why they didn't do it.
Hmm. Becca, Mayor Pureval did issue a declaration of emergency. What does that mean for the city and all the residents?
Yeah, so this was issued on Tuesday evening, obviously after the storms. Even the storm on Tuesday afternoon had cleared, but it's really more about recovery than it is about an active situation happening. So in this case, it's the type of thing that the city can do during the pandemic, for example. There was an emergency declared there. It can be used for things like riots or civil unrest. In this case, the mayor says there are really two reasons that it is useful. One is locally, it relaxes some of the procurement rules that the city has to follow in terms of spending money. And so it's a way to potentially get money out the door faster. The mayor has said he is working on some grant funding program that can support homeowners and business owners that were affected by this flooding. We don't have any details on that yet, who would be eligible, where that money would come from, et cetera. But the emergency declaration will theoretically make that an easier thing to do and a quicker thing to do. The other thing is it's a necessary step for the city to seek state and or federal assistance. So there is potentially disaster relief aid that could be unlocked. Now, importantly, it is not up to the city to decide if we are eligible for that. The emergency declaration is the local step that needs to happen. The mayor says he's been in communication with state and federal officials, or I think just state officials at this point. But there will have to be, kind of their own level of analysis of the situation to see if there's enough damage, for example, to qualify for that kind of assistance.
Chris, any idea whether the city will qualify for state or federal funding to help with all this?
I have no idea. I mean, Congressman Landsman, who represents the area in Congress, said that, they're working on it as well. The question, I think, is whether this was widespread enough to generate that kind of declaration. There's also a question of politics. Trump administration, not a fan of Governor DeWine, not a fan of Democratic cities. And, there's been some reporting about there's been a little bit of a difference between red states and blue states and red states and blue areas about these things. But on a you know, the base level of this, you know, they may not qualify because of the, you know, 1,500 people may not be enough in terms of the damage that has occurred.
Yeah, or I guess even the dollar threshold amount that Correct. Has to be reached for and that.
Which we also don't know that the city is still compiling.
Yeah. Well, as you all mentioned earlier, City Manager Cheryl Long held a news conference Thursday, and she talked about the challenges the city is facing.
These were intense, uncommonly powerful storms. And while we cannot control the weather, we can control our response to natural disasters. We have a responsibility to help our residents and visitors to maintain infrastructure that protects our city during emergencies, and to be transparent about how we're going to solve problems.
Esther, this is a big question, but how is climate change contributing to the frequency of storms like this?
Yeah, so kind of like I mentioned, these storms are really powered by moisture evaporating into the atmosphere and collecting and then condensing and falling. What's happening with climate change is that the global temperatures are going up, which means this process is basically speeding up, and it's happening a lot more frequently. And climate change is also changing wind patterns, which means that these storms tend to linger in cities like Cincinnati for longer periods of time, which is part of why such intense rainfall happened on July 17th. Mm.
Esther, does Cincinnati's urban landscape contribute to this problem too?
There is some preliminary research that shows that at the very least, Cincinnati as an urban area gives off more heat than like rural green spaces. And obviously, since heat is kind of a big factor in the process of this, there is some evidence to show that that has an impact. But I think in terms of the flooding, that's where we're really seeing like the urban landscape having a bigger impact, is we have a lot of impervious surfaces that is just not conducive to quick water, like getting water out of places.
Yeah, no absorption in that. Chris, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, the big question I have, and we were trying to get a little bit at this the other day or yesterday, this morning, based on some questions I asked at the news conference yesterday. You know, what does the city have some ability to try to deal with not necessarily the 1,000-year flood, but the repeated flooding that we kind of see in Hyde Park Square frequently? And I also wonder, and I don't have the answer to this question, whether we all need to think about looking at buying flood insurance, even though we are not Floridians, we don't live near the beach, but this kind of thing has happened before in other cities, Houston, Asheville, where they've had hurricanes sit over and really pound their areas with rain. And, I think that's an unanswered question, but, you know, I do wonder whether we need additional insurance in order to deal with these things.
Yeah. Well, Esther, with all these factors we've been talking about, should we be worried that these are not once-in-a-lifetime storms, that we could be seeing a lot more of these severe storms more often?
According to climatologists, the classification of a 1,000-year storm is really a statistical probability measurement. And what's happening is if climate change is kind of changing up the patterns that are happening to produce this type of weather, there's really like the model that we use to predict these storms is kind of outdated. It's no longer up to speed with what climate change is doing. So yes, it is probable, or possible, I will say, that we will get another serious storm. But there's like no way to really know that for sure, basically.
Yeah, hard to predict it. Well, here's what City Manager Cheryl Long had to say about that.
This was a wake-up call for all of us, and it needs to be for our regional partners as well. These weather events will become more frequent. We've seen what happened in the winter months with our storms. We can't pretend this isn't true. And so making improvements is slow and it's costly. And we need to collaborate as a region to move the needle to solve this issue.
Becca, what are the next steps for city leaders, for MSD, for all the different agencies and utilities that are involved in this work?
I think mostly what we know is focused on the short term. So for the sewer backups, for example, MSD Director Diana Christie has said that they do seem to have sufficient funding in reserve to handle the immediate cleanup. So things like cleaning up after a sewer backup and that kind of thing. Another aspect of this, though, is if a sewer backup is determined, or if water damage, maybe more broadly, is determined to have been caused by a sewer backup due to incapacity of the sewer system, then MSD is liable for supporting the repairs to that, or for damages for lost property, for example. That can be extremely costly. It happens every year. MSD sets aside a certain amount of money, but we have not seen a storm like this before. So that part might be the county commissioners might need to be involved in that aspect in approving additional funding since they approve the budget. Other short-term things like the floodgate, for example, you know, there's talk of we're putting the plan in place. We have engineers flying in on Monday to, you know, help us evaluate this and working with the Army Corps of Engineers who designed and installed the gate and trying to come up with that. And long-term, I think it's a lot of question marks. You know, what we've heard from city officials, the mayor and the city manager, is that they're taking it seriously, that they will be, you know, looking at the expert opinion and trying to see what to do. But in terms of infrastructure, money is limited. We know this from, you know, the few potholes that are filled and the pavement that's done. Like, there's lots of other priorities that the city is focused on. And I think there's a lot of unanswered questions that we'll need to be following over the next couple months.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with WBXU local government reporter Becca Costello, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and Cincinnati Enquirer Health and Environment Enterprise reporter Esther Launstein. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, the Ohio EPA's decision related to how data centers can discharge wastewater. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency has been considering a proposal to make it easier for data centers to discharge wastewater into rivers and streams. Joining me now to explain the proposal and what the Ohio EPA has decided is Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey, good to be here.
Great to have you. So tell us more about this proposal. What was the Ohio EPA considering, and what would it have allowed?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially right now, the vast majority of data centers in Ohio are discharging their wastewater to wastewater treatment facilities, you know, where everyone else's wastewater goes. But there are permits called National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits that allow discharges into freshwater systems. That's lakes, rivers, streams. One data center in Ohio has one of those permits, but the EPA was considering streamlining the process and making it a little easier for other data centers in Ohio to apply for them. So it would have kind of been a one-size-fits-all permit. So that's essentially what the EPA was considering. And spoiler alert, they have decided not to move forward with the proposal.
Okay. And they announced that decision earlier this week. How did the Ohio EPA explain that decision?
So the EPA said that they received a, quote, significant volume of comments against the proposal and that they were listening to public comment. So this idea came out several months ago, and they were soliciting public comments back in February. I had heard that they had received thousands upon thousands of comments, and the Alliance for the Great Lakes, which is an environmental organization that advocates on behalf of all of the Great Lakes, including Lake Erie, which, of course, this proposal would have impacted. They told me, you know, the EPA has to respond to all those public comments. So they were kind of barraged with public comments and just decided that, you know, they weren't going to move forward. They said that continuing to issue these NPDES permits on a case-by-case basis is the most appropriate path forward.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question, how the agency is going to decide how to issue these wastewater disposal or discharge permits for data centers, and they're just going to decide case by case, look at each data center individually?
Exactly. So nothing under the current system is really going to change. These NPDES permits were already in the system. They existed. So again, it's not saying that the EPA is saying, no, you can't discharge into freshwater, but you have to go, if a data center wants to do so, they have to go through a stricter permitting process, because some of the folks who were opposed to this idea's concerns were that, you know, there was just less oversight into this more generalized permit.
Well, what were the environmental concerns that people had about this proposal?
Absolutely. So obviously the EPA sets water standards in a lot of different ways, but for wastewater treatment facilities, like, they're already equipped to treat wastewater. Whereas if data centers are discharging, or any major manufacturer is discharging into freshwater, when you think about data centers, for example, there are tons of different types of data centers, in the sense that some are really big, some are really small. They have different ways that they cool the facilities, but the vast majority of data centers do need some sort of cooling system. So, like, the Alliance for the Great Lakes was concerned that some of the discharges that would be going into lakes and rivers and streams would be much warmer than the water temperature. That causes potential issues for wildlife, for fish. And I should note that this proposal, it was considering discharges into Lake Erie as well as inland rivers and streams. Inland lakes were not part of the proposal.
Hmm. Are there any politicians who've been talking about this proposal specifically, and how this wastewater discharge is permitted?
Absolutely. So it caught U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno's attention back in February. So he put out a statement against it back in February. But more recently, in the last couple of weeks, both Moreno as well as Democratic gubernatorial candidate Amy Acton voiced concerns with the EPA rules. I mean, Moreno said, quote, "This nonsense needs to end." Acton wrote that she believes data centers should never discharge their water usage into lakes in Ohio. So it's interesting, because I'm sure we've all seen, and certainly as a reporter, I've been following the way that the public opinion has really shifted against data centers in the last 9 months to a year. Of course, you know, there was a proposal to try and ban large-scale data centers. They were circulating petitions. They don't have enough signatures to get that on the ballot, but certainly folks are expressing a lot of different concerns about data centers, and it looks like politicians are trying to figure out where they're at, because it's not all politicians are coming out and pushing for stricter regulations. But, you know, both Moreno and Acton, who probably rarely find themselves on the same side, spoke out against this one.
Well, I think you mentioned, but how many data centers have been allowed to discharge their wastewater into fresh water at this point? Did you say there's only been one that's been allowed to?
Yeah, and that's my understanding based on my conversation with the Alliance for the Great Lakes, because they track this sort of stuff. I could not tell you which data center in Ohio has that existing NPDES permit, but there's only one that has that permit. So, you know, obviously, if the EPA was looking at streamlining it, maybe they had gotten some interest from some other data centers to make it a little bit easier to get these permits. But right now, only one data center actually discharges into fresh water under that permit.
Have you heard anything from the industry about this decision that the Ohio EPA made?
I haven't so far. And, you know, I kind of did a cursory glance. I looked around a little bit. Of course, you know, I think that there are a lot of different issues that data center industry folks are trying to respond to right now. So I'm not necessarily shocked that they didn't weigh in on this one in particular, especially because, of course, you know, if the permit had been more streamlined, maybe more data centers would have taken advantage of it. But the Alliance for the Great Lakes tells me that they think things are really going to stay the same for the time being with permitting. And of course, you know, data centers are able to get those permits to discharge to wastewater treatment facilities. So it's tough to say. There hasn't been real pushback from the data center industry against pausing this proposal.
Okay. Well, while we've got you here, Sarah, I want to talk to you about another issue that I know you've been following very closely for months and months now. We've talked with you about THC seltzers that were sold legally in Ohio until a ban took effect. I think that was in March, but now that's changed, sort of. Can you explain what happened with all that?
Yeah, absolutely. So lawmakers, obviously, so there was a federal ban that was put into place last November. That's set to take effect this November. So state lawmakers had already been working on trying to figure out a way to either regulate or ban so-called intoxicating hemp. And they ultimately tried to carve these hemp-infused THC and CBD beverages out of the broader hemp ban that they put into effect. But then Governor DeWine used his line item veto power and vetoed that. So basically, in March, hemp-infused beverages in Ohio became illegal. So there were a lot of different ways that the industry tried to push back on this. You know, there are certainly folks who have been lobbying lawmakers to try and get a veto override vote through. There was also a referendum effort on that. So people were trying to get signatures to try and pause the law from taking effect, but they didn't get enough signatures. But of course, like with most laws, there are also lawsuits. So there were at least two lawsuits that I know about that were filed against this law, but one of them was filed in federal court over the Commerce Clause. And it argues that, you know, this is something that's interstate commerce, it's affecting interstate commerce. And a judge sided with the retailers and the businesses who were on that lawsuit and said they're likely to succeed on the merits of their case. So he's granted them a preliminary injunction. But like you said, it's only some businesses. So only the businesses that were on the lawsuit are currently legally able to sell their products. There are a lot of other businesses. Namely, I talked to Cincinnati-based 50 West Brewing Company who cannot sell their products because they were not a part of the lawsuit.
Well, and there were several lawsuits filed, right, with different groups of people involved. I mean, so this is this lift of the ban only applies to the businesses involved in this particular lawsuit?
Exactly. There was another effort to sue over Governor DeWine using it as a line item veto. So that was a very technical lawsuit. Mm. And ultimately, I believe the Ohio Supreme Court struck that one down. But this one, the retailers on it and businesses on it, you know, Saucy Brew Works is one of them. So they're based out of Cleveland. They were named on the lawsuit and are able to sell their products. But again, it's not like in some other cases when a state law has been put on a preliminary injunction and everyone, it applies to everyone. This only applies to the businesses who sued. Hmm.
You've mentioned a couple of times that Governor Mike DeWine vetoed that provision that would have carved out an exemption for hemp-infused beverages. And there are, you know, the industry's lobbying lawmakers to override that veto. Is there any chance that could still happen, that the lawmakers could still vote to override that veto?
Yes. So there is still time for lawmakers to do that. Lawmakers have to take a veto override vote, just the same legislative session that Governor DeWine issued the veto. So he issued the veto in like December. They would just have to vote before they are adjourned in December of this year, because they end this legislative session at the end of the calendar year. That being said, it's tough to say what that actually looks like, because you know, lawmakers right now are out on summer recess. They're out in their districts campaigning, and they probably won't be back and doing any serious work until late November at the earliest, which is during what's called lame duck. So that'll be more of we'll have a better idea closer to lame duck if there is actually the votes to do any sort of a veto override, because quite frankly, it's also going to be dependent on what the federal government does. And, you know, local businesses are certainly watching that federal decision as well, because even though there is a ban set to go into effect November 12th, that of course Ohio would be subject to, there's a chance that lawmakers at the federal level change their mind as well.
Okay, well, I have been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thanks so much for your time today, Sarah. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Up next, protesters arrested on the suspension bridge sue the city of Covington and police officers there. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. You might remember a protest march across the Roebling Suspension Bridge last July that resulted in several arrests. Now, some of the people who were arrested are suing. Join me now to explain who's suing and what those lawsuits allege is WVXU long-form investigative reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy.
Thanks so much for being here. So, as I mentioned, several people involved in this protest march last year have filed lawsuits against the city of Covington and some police officers, right? Tell us just briefly who's suing, what generally are they alleging in these lawsuits?
Sure. So this is four different lawsuits that have some of the same claims, but some different claims too. Brandon Hill, Suzanne Bratt, and Logan Ember have all filed lawsuits in federal court against the city of Covington and various police officers. In addition to that, a fourth person, Taylor Marshall, filed a pretty similar lawsuit in Kenton County Circuit Court. And these are over the police response to the march that took place July 17th, 2025, across the Roebling, related to the ICE detention of Ayman Soliman. It started as a kind of a vigil on the Cincinnati side, and then marchers kind of started across the bridge, about 100 of them, where they were met by Covington police and other Northern Kentucky law enforcement.
Yeah. And what's the common thread among all four of those lawsuits? Does it relate to how they were arrested or how the police treated them?
Sure. All four have some First Amendment claims, you know, saying they were exercising their First Amendment rights, and that while they were doing that, police used excessive force to arrest them, and that there were injuries that resulted from that excessive force. They're also suing the city of Covington, saying, you know, there needed to be better training and that the city kind of like allowed this to happen by employing these officers. Hmm.
I think you mentioned about 100 people took part in this march that across the bridge. How many people were arrested ultimately?
15 were arrested at the event.
Okay. And was this a peaceful protest?
You know, I think people throw that word around back and forth, and sometimes it means different things. From what I saw on the bridge and from, you know, kind of a lot of the description, yes, the vigil was exceptionally calm and quiet. And then the march itself, there wasn't a lot of conflict. There was almost none until the police response.
Okay. Well, and you were there, Nick. I know you were there when this happened a little more than a year ago. What did you observe in terms of how officers interacted with these protesters?
Sure. So Northern Kentucky law enforcement, including Covington Police Department, met the protesters about halfway across the bridge, roughly. They gave an order to disperse and within a minute begin arresting people. That included a couple journalists with City Beat. It also included some folks who were making their way onto the walkways on the side of the bridge, as they were instructed to do, or who were already on the walkways. So the arrests happened pretty quickly after the order to disperse, and a lot of folks who were trying to get off the bridge were able to do so. Others were not.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a little bit tricky. I walk along that bridge all the time, and there are kind of these cables that if you're actually on the bridge deck, you have to kind of snake through those to get to the walkway, right?
Absolutely. And that plays into one of the lawsuits, which we might get into in a minute here.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you also observed physical contact between some officers and at least one protester, didn't you?
Yes. As the arrests were happening, there was one person we later know, Brandon Hill is his name, who was arrested. He seemed to have been detained on the middle of the bridge or near the edge of the bridge. He was then taken out over to the side on the walkway. An officer was seen kind of punching him in the head multiple times while he was being subdued. And then after he was subdued, we learned that officer's name was Zachary Staten later. And Hill has filed his lawsuit about excessive force related to that incident.
Mm-hmm. What do police say about Brandon Hill in particular? Have they tried to offer an explanation for that conduct?
Yeah, they say that he approached an officer in the middle of the bridge with his fist balled up and called that a fighting stance during the march. And that he also grabbed an officer's non-lethal projectile gun. So kind of like I don't know if it was a beanbag gun or some other kind of gun. The police testified that Hill made motions like he was reaching into a bag with him and that officers thought he had a gun. Now, Hill disputes a lot of this. I will say I did not witness some of this happening, some of these motions and the fists being balled up. And I haven't seen them on some of the video either.
Mm-hmm. Are any of these people who were arrested, or especially the people who are suing, do they still face charges related to the march?
Hill could be indicted on a felony rioting charge still. A judge ruled there's sufficient evidence for that. Prosecutors have not said that they won't seek that charge, but they also haven't had a grand jury indict him yet. So he's kind of in a little bit of legal limbo. The others who have filed these charges or these lawsuits pled down to lesser charges, misdemeanors, or in one case, prosecutors dropped that down to a misdemeanor before they pled. So,
okay. Well, let's get into some of the specifics of these four lawsuits. Can you walk us through them kind of one by one?
Sure. The first is the one we discussed with Brandon Hill and Officer Staten. And again, he, you know, takes issue with the fact that he was punched multiple times while he was being subdued and while he was subdued. And so he's asking for a jury trial and damages for compensation and also, you know, punitive damages. We then have the three others, and they're all about kind of different incidents that happened. Ember's federal lawsuit makes similar claims about constitutional rights, but says that there were, you know, three officers involved. Also Staten, the same one involved in Hill's case, but Ember claims that Staten punched her in the head, pulled her hair, pushed her face into the sidewalk, and then the other officers involved could have intervened and stopped that from happening and didn't. So that's kind of the basis for her lawsuit. And she claims that she was injured, bruised, had some trauma after the event that has impacted her. Brat's lawsuit names another officer named Ross Woodward and claims that her constitutional rights were violated. According to the filing, Woodward seized Brat from behind and took her to the ground, despite the fact she was trying to comply with the orders to disperse. And that's where the sort of like cabling comes into play. She was trying to get through that cabling when the officer allegedly grabbed her. She's saying there was no need for her to be arrested and that, you know, she shouldn't have been placed in the situation or placed with this, you know, excessive force to begin with. The fourth one, Marshall, his suit claims Woodward and some an unnamed officer were retaliating against him for exercising his First Amendment rights. He says Woodward hit him on the head multiple times, caused a concussion, and that he's had memory loss and other issues. He says that in his suit that he's missed work and opportunities for employment due to those injuries. He's the one that pleaded down to a misdemeanor, one of the ones.
Hmm. And have any of the officers that are named in these lawsuits or were involved in this whole incident, have any of them faced disciplinary action?
Just Zachary Staten. And Staten, he received a one-month unpaid suspension from the Covington Police Department, and that was in relation to the incident with Ember. And he's, you know, back on the force now. Ember's lawsuit notes that Covington found, in its own words, that Specialist Staten failed to de-escalate once the threat of further assault had been mitigated. So other than that, Covington police stand behind the response that their officers brought to this incident.
Hmm. And I think you mentioned this with one of the lawsuits, but generally, what are these lawsuits seeking?
So all four lawsuits are seeking this a jury trial, so a jury can kind of hear the claims, and then compensatory damages. So that would be, you know, lost wages, medical bills, that kind of thing. But then also punitive damages, kind of like to send a message to, you know, other, you know, police departments and things like, hey, you're going to have to pay for this.
Mm-hmm. Has the city of Covington or the police chief or anybody like that responded to these lawsuits specifically?
Yeah, the city of Covington issued a statement pointing out that that some of the defendants had faced felony charges, that a judge had found probable cause for those felony charges, and also said that the protest on the bridge created significant public safety concerns and that this response was necessary to ensure safety.
And that was kind of what the city of Covington and the police department's been saying from the start, right, that it wasn't safe for these for this march to happen on the bridge deck. Has that kind of been their position from the beginning?
Yes. Yeah. They issued a statement, and Police Chief Justin Wheatholder defended the department's overall response to the march. They said, you know, officers are going to receive some additional training in de-escalation and responding to unlawful protests, but that they, you know, they responded the way they needed to make people safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, we appreciate your reporting on that, Nick, and I know you'll continue to follow those cases as they work their way through the various courts. I want to take an opportunity to look ahead a little bit, which we don't always get to do on the News Review. I know you've been working on a story that's going to air next week. Can you tell us about it? I am very interested in this personally, I will say.
Sure. And we are looking both behind and ahead because this already aired on WVXU. It's airing on today from the Ohio Newsroom Monday. And so it'll air again on VXU as well. And it's about City of Cincinnati's Code Inspector Academy. Cincinnati and a bunch of other cities, both in Ohio and across the country, are facing this really big shortage of code inspectors who they approve building permits to make sure buildings are built safely, and also inspect existing structures to make sure, you know, like your apartment is safe and that your landlord's doing what they're supposed to. There's a lot of retirement going on in the industry right now, and not enough tradespeople coming in to fill those jobs. Generally, you need about 5 years in the trades before you can become an inspector, be certified. And what this program does is kind of bypasses that and takes folks from other walks of life and does a very intensive training program, gets them certified through the state the way a normal code inspector would be, and gets them out doing code inspector work.
Yeah. And this is such important work. I know you and I have both covered this in different chapters of our lives, but I mean, this is making sure pieces of buildings don't fall on the public, that people don't fall through floors. I mean, this is really important work these people do.
Exactly. We've both reported on, for instance, you know, housing conditions in the city and how sometimes, you know, those are not safe for people or not livable, you know, ceilings collapsing in, you know, sewage flooding into places. These inspectors, I've relied on their work for stories I've reported on. And I think a lot of people rely on them to make sure that their buildings are safe. So it's good we're getting more of them.
Yeah. And good that they're getting the training they need. And I guess for your upcoming look, will you be looking at how some other cities deal with this problem too?
Yeah, there's a really interesting wrinkle in this, in that other cities, when they don't have enough inspectors, have taken to AI and even putting cameras on some of their municipal vehicles to kind of watch the outside of buildings, which has raised some concerns among some people. I can see why people might be freaked out about that. And Cincinnati's saying, like, we got the opposite approach. We're taking people from Cincinnati neighborhoods and putting them back out in the neighborhoods to make sure they're safe.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I have
been talking with WVXU long-form investigative reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you so much for your time today. Hope you have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too, Lucy. Thanks.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. Even YouTube. We're on YouTube now. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.